Hi everyone, Carl here. Just before we get started, I wanted to point out that if you're in the US, the book we're discussing today, Dynamic Dames, is already on sale. However, the UK release date is not until later this month on July 25th. Okay, let's get on with the show. Welcome back, everybody, to the Movie Palace. I'm your host, as ever, Carl Sweeney, and thanks for joining me again this week. Now, on this episode, we're not talking about one particular film. Instead, we're talking about a new book from TCM and Running Press, which is called Dynamic Dames, 50 Leading Ladies Who Made History. And I'm absolutely delighted to be joined by the book's author, Sloane DeForest. Hi, Sloane.
Hi, Carl. I'm absolutely delighted to be joining you.
Yeah, well, thanks for coming on the podcast, first of all. And yeah, how's everything your end? You're in California, is that right?
I am. I'm in Los Angeles here. It's a little bit cold and gray and gloomy. I guess you might feel at home being from England here today.
Yes, I'm somewhat familiar with weather like that. It's true. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we're going to talk all about your book, which I've been delighted. I've just read it over the weekend. Really enjoyed it.
Oh, great.
Yeah, but before we do, I just thought, you know, seeing as it's the first time we've spoken, I just thought it'd be nice to get to know a little bit more about yourself. So can you tell me, Sloane, a bit about how you became a film fan? That's what I normally like to start off with when I have new people on the podcast. So yeah, how did your interest in films begin?
Well, wow, it just has almost always been there, you know? My mother took me to movies. My mother is a film fan, I think probably is the short answer. And she took me and my sister to movies starting from the time we were little, just because she enjoyed it and she thought it was something we would all enjoy together. And so she grew up in the 50s, she was born in the 40s. So kind of grew up watching the more studio classic era films and she would watch those occasionally. And I guess I was exposed to them from her, but it took a while to sort of creep up on me that I wanted to, that I was, you know, passionate about movies and particularly classic movies and, that I wanted to write about them or that I wanted to, you know, be kind of a film historian. It was just, or slow sort of evolutionary organic process, I guess, of loving movies and just getting more and more into movies over the years. And I started acting, when I was in my early 20s. So that was what I thought that I wanted to do really is, oh, I want to be in the movies. Mm-hmm. I want to be a movie star myself, you know. But really the writing kind of took over, you know, the appreciation of these great films. You know, I could never be Garbo, no matter how hard I try. So I think that was kind of my journey.
So in terms of like the classic era films, the classic Hollywood studio system films, I mean, it's quite hard to summarize perhaps, but what is it about that era of filmmaking or that style of filmmaking that you think appeals so much to you?
Well, why does it appeal to all of us? You know, people either just don't care for it or they're just passionately in love with it, I feel, don't you? Those of us who love it, you know, we love the style. We love the fact that there was so much effort put into story, into these great characters, into the cinematography, the beautiful black and white cinematography or the Technicolor, attention to detail. Just we'll never see that attention to detail again in Hollywood, you know, of that caliber in that way with that kind of style and that glamour.
So I guess the most obvious kind of question to throw at you is kind of favorite films or favorite stars from that era. And I guess perhaps you've written about some of them in the book in truth. But yeah, if I say to you favorite films from the Hollywood studio system or favorite stars, what names immediately spring to mind?
Yeah, the ones that spring to mind for me are Greta Garbo, for sure. I've always admired her acting, her look. She's just amazing in front of the camera. Mm-hmm. you know, I've always loved Grace Kelly in Rear Window. She made it into my book as well.
Yep.
So I had to get her in there because I grew up on that movie. You know, that's another one that my mom and I enjoyed together and watched it, you know, probably 100 times, is just have it memorized. You know, there's, I mean, I've always loved Marilyn as well. Marilyn's not in the book, but I grew up on Marilyn Monroe in 7 Year Itch and Gentlemen Prefer Blondes with Jane Russell. Gosh, there's so many. Sunset Boulevard is one of my all-time favorites. With, you know, I don't know that I would say I'm necessarily a big Gloria Swanson fan, but she's amazing, you know, and what an amazing career and what an amazing comeback in Sunset Boulevard. And, ugh. I just love that movie. So yes, I could go on and on and on, but those are a few that spring to mind.
Yeah, and we'll get into some of this a bit more when we come on to Dynamic Dames, I guess. But one tidbit I was intrigued to learn about when I looked at your website is that I believe there are some interesting film-related names in your family tree. I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, actually, you know, when I grew up, when I was a kid, my father used to tell me we're related to Lee DeForest, who is the father of radio. Mm-hmm. And I never knew what that meant. You know, did he invent radio? I was not clear on exactly why he was the father of radio. So my father passed away, you know, when I was fairly young. So I really didn't get to talk much to him about this and his side of the family, the DeForest family. So it wasn't until I became obsessed with movies and silent film and early talkies and in that whole era that I learned who Lee DeForest really was as far as the film world goes and how he basically invented the sound on film process for talking pictures. Perfected it in 1923, and all of that, you know, I did some digging into my family tree and found out, yes, in fact, we are related. He's my great-great-grandfather's mm-hmm. nephew, actually. So that was really cool to discover. And then I'm reading a book about Lee DeForest, and I find that he's related to Bebe Daniels. She's also in the DeForest family tree. The actress from, many people probably know her from 42nd Street, but she was a great silent film star as well. So, yeah, kind of exciting to discover that once I'm already a fan, you know, not having grown up knowing it.
It is exciting. It is cool. Mm-hmm. And so I suppose you've already alluded to this somewhat, but I was just curious in how you got into writing about films. So you've already kind of said you kind of backed into it and transitioned away from acting. Is that right? So how exactly did it kind of pan out?
Yeah, you know, I had been acting, and I was up until just a few years ago, I was doing commercials and some independent films and things like that. And I was doing some screenwriting on my own. I really kind of aspired to be, I always aspired to transition into writing, I guess, from acting, but I more was thinking of being a screenwriter. You know, I got a job at the Mary Pickford Foundation. This was in 2012. And I was really learning a lot about Mary Pickford. I was doing some writing about Mary Pickford, and I was contributing to a book that was being written about Mary Pickford. And one of the people working on the book sort of said, hey, you're a good writer and you're knowledgeable about classic film and I like your writing style and you're also a good editor, because I'd been trained as an editor, you know, of words as well. So he just sort of hired me to contribute to his book. This was Manoah Bowman I'm talking about, who is also a TCM author. He wrote Natalie Wood, Reflections on a Legendary Life, which is a beautiful, beautiful coffee table book. And not just a coffee table book. I mean, this is a really, you know, there's new information in the book about Natalie Wood. I recommend this book to anyone who's a Natalie Wood fan. And not just because I was involved in it. It's really a great book. But but I got to contribute an essay to that, and I did some editing on the book. And so that just kind of started me on the path to write my own book for Turner Classic Movies and Running Press, which is what I did.
Yeah, so I was going to ask you about this. So this is must-see sci-fi, is that right?
Right, that was my first book.
Yeah, so I'll confess I haven't read that book yet. I do want to, but on a previous podcast episode, frequent guest of the podcast, Raquel Stepcher, talked about it in kind of glowing terms. And yeah, can you kind of pitch or kind of tee up that book for us? Is it a kind of intended as an educational tool for people who are maybe getting into sci-fi? Is that the kind of audience it's pitched at?
Yeah, exactly. It's Raquel is great, by the way. She's a big advocate of mine, which I so appreciate. And Yes, my first book, The Must-See Sci-Fi, was written with Turner Classic Movies, as I said. So it's not a book aimed at the people who already know everything about sci-fi. And I'm telling you, with sci-fi fans, there are people who know everything. So this is more about people who are casually interested in classic science fiction and maybe newer science fiction and sort of just really delving into the genre.
Okay, so let's talk about this new book then. So Dynamic Dames. So I guess the first question, and, you know, for people who haven't yet checked out the book or are kind of weighing up whether or not to pick it up. So how are you using the term dynamic dames? What does it mean? What constitutes a dynamic dame?
Yeah, dynamic dames is really just my fancy way of saying, you know, a powerful female movie character. You know, the origin of the phrase I came up with Camilla Jackson, who's a producer and a programmer at the Arena Cine Lounge here in Hollywood, which is an independent movie theater. We originated that phrase as a way of describing these kind of strong female protagonists in the movies. Because, you know, dynamic is really... is sort of like a catalyst for change, you know. And these women are all, because I wanted it to incorporate a broad group of women, no pun intended with the word broad, right? But I wanted it to include a variety of different types of characters, not just like the superpowered, obvious Wonder Woman, you know, kind of thing like that, but a whole different range of women. So dynamic is a woman who is, she's the hero of her own journey. She's making things happen in her world. She's not just sitting back passively and looking pretty. And dame is, a word that I'm reclaiming for women, which I think is offensive at all. It's, I guess, can be kind of considered like a slang term for a woman. But, you know, when you, its origin is dame, French, which just means lady. So to me, that's not, there's nothing wrong with that. And when you think of the word dame, what comes to mind? But to me, these fast talking dames, 1930s, you know, Barbara Stanwyck and Rosalind Russell and His Girl Friday. So yeah, I like the term dynamic dames, but it really just means, you know, these powerful women in the movies who were not heroines, because a heroine could imply that they're sort of a damsel in distress who's rescued by the hero. I really want these women to be heroes. You know, that's another word that I apply to these women. They're the heroes of their journey.
Yeah, and I think it's fascinating that you used the word reclaiming a little earlier there, because I think there's quite a lot of reclaiming going on in various ways through the book, really. So I guess it's important to stress that, you know, this podcast is themed around sort of classic era films, but that's not entirely what this book is it? So this is 50 leading ladies from across Hollywood history, really. So yeah, I was just wondering if you could talk a little about the balance in the book between sort of older films and the more contemporary ones. Was it easy to achieve that balance?
Yes, it was pretty easy because, you know, we're coming into an era where finally we're getting some very strong, empowered leading roles for women, but there's still very few and far between. So, I mean, you know, now that I'm thinking about it, and I hadn't really thought about it this way before until you just asked the question, but the first, let's say that roughly half of the book is from classic Hollywood and roughly half of it is from, you know, newer Hollywood.
Yeah.
I mean, it probably took me from 1980 up to 2018 to find as many strong female characters as could be found more routinely in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, if that makes sense. I could write a whole book about just the 30s, 40s, and 50s dynamic dames, because those, to me, it was a whole different era for women in Hollywood. And that's one of the points that maybe you'll get to that in a minute. I don't want to jump ahead, but that's kind of one of the points that I don't want to put too fine a point on in the book, but I definitely hope comes across, is that this, it hasn't always been this way, where the strong roles for leading ladies have been so few and far between.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about this, actually. I mean, you've kind of answered the question, but I was thinking about the way Hollywood has changed over the decades for female performers. So there are these aspects of classic Hollywood that the industry moved away from for whatever reason, whether it's, you know, screwball comedies or, you know, the so-called women's picture. And it just seems really regrettable to me. So why do you think that happened? And I assume the answer to the second part is yes, but, you know, would Hollywood benefit from going back to the past in some respects?
Definitely. I mean, I was just looking at some numbers. I'm just really getting into this topic right now, in fact, because I'm preparing a presentation to do at Larry Edmonds Bookstore when we sort of launch the book next month. Mm-hmm. And I want to do something of this theme, you know, sort of like the secret history of dynamic dames, which is, wow, there used to be a lot of dynamic dames in movies. What the hell happened? You know, just to your question. Exactly. That's a great question. I mean, it's, you know, I can't, obviously there's not time for me to go deeply, deeply into it, but basically, you know, Hollywood was very much geared toward women as an audience in the 30s and early 40s particularly, but really through the entire 40s, mainly because of the war, you know. Yeah. It seemed like the 30s was really the decade for women. I mean, if you think of the characters Barbara Stanwyck and Joan Crawford and, you know, Betty Davis were playing, Mae West, of course, you know, in the 30s, these were practically all dynamic dames. You know, you take your pick, you know. And then the war started to come along, and you saw kind of a trend for war pictures in the early 40s, and it started to get a little more male-dominated. But then when the United States entered World War II, you know, late 41 into 42, when it really started, you know, the men were being sent off to war. So yep. Once again, Hollywood became a woman's town. You know, it was really mostly women going to the movies at that point. So it was really throughout the 30s and 40s that Hollywood movies were geared toward women. One of the statistics I use in the book, in 1935, Samuel Goldwyn estimated that, you know, 70% of movie audiences were female. So that gives you an idea, you know, that it was really dominated. And when you look at the print media at that time, which I'm sure you have, the movie magazines, I mean, it's what, 90% women on the cover, you know? What happened was, after the war, that's when the attitude shifted. It was, you know, let's move to the suburbs. A lot of women had been going to movies, you know, in the city. There weren't movie theaters in the suburbs. Mm-hmm. They were expected to sort of sit at home all day, and there was television to watch. So that's when it shifted. It became women sort of expected to sit at home and watch soap operas instead of going to the movies. That's when it started to decline. Yes, to answer your question.
Okay, then. So how about the number 50 here then? So 50 leading ladies. Did you have a long list that came down to 50, or how exactly did you set about doing that?
Yeah, I probably had a much longer list that I whittled down to 50. And there was really no sort of academic rubric that I used, you know, to determine it. Basically, I just wanted it to be women who were the leading characters for the most part in the story. Yeah. You know, there are some great minor characters that, you know, that are empowered women. But I wanted it to be the heroes, as I said, of the journey. I wanted it to be, have some diversity. I wanted it to be, you know, a mix of older and newer. And I wanted it to be all women who, I guess, really stand out and who are memorable in their roles. And some of them are more obscure, granted. But I just sort of balanced it out with who I thought would be the best choice. And some of them got cut for sure.
And one of the things you say in the introduction to the book about this group as a whole is that they transcend the narrow confines of their gender role. And that sort of struck me as an important point, you know, the idea that, or the capacity of an individual woman to take something that's quite limited in some ways and do something really meaningful with it. It's something that's actually a bit of a recurring theme on this podcast that we talk about from time to time. But do you think that's a fair way to put it? Does that seem like a fair assessment to you?
Yes, yes. Again, I don't want to put too fine a point on it. And you know, really, I didn't want this book to sound like a militant feminist agenda. But they're definitely feminist characters. That's what was in my mind, is a woman who can, you know, face adversity or face being discriminated against in some way or underestimated even just in general because she's a woman, and sort of triumph over that for sure.
And I was thinking about some of the very recent examples in the book. So things like Wonder Woman or Charlize Theron's character in Mad Max Fury Road or Keira Knightley in Colette. And again, in that introduction, you mentioned that the industry is on the cusp of change. So I'm just kind of wondering what your assessment is about the circumstances that today's women in Hollywood find themselves in. And are you confident that the sea change that hopefully is underway will be lasting and meaningful?
I hope that it is. I'm hopeful, confident. No, because I've seen it happen too many times before. Mm. In 1991, we had Clarice Starling, Jodie Foster in Silence of the Lambs, who won the Oscar. And we had, Susan Sarandon and Gina Davis in Thelma and Louise, two huge groundbreaking films for women. And everyone sort of thought this is a new era dawning for strong women in the movies. And what happened is it was the exact opposite. I feel like Hollywood ran scared from those movies once it released them. And it sort of backtracked. There was a bit of a backlash mm-hmm. for years throughout the 90s, from what I can tell. They really didn't have any, they didn't follow those up with any other strong female roles that were that powerful. So again, there's a lot of talk these days. There's a lot of talk and you see a little change, but I don't know, like I'm looking at the numbers, I don't see a whole lot of new movies. I try to catch them eventually. So, I'm not the expert on contemporary cinema, but I keep abreast of what's going on and I look at these movies and I think, okay, where are all the strong female characters? I think the ones we do have get a lot of hype, like Captain Marvel, mm-hmm. for example, is a recent one, but that's one movie per year. You know what I mean? I don't see the numbers really rising as far as the amount of powerful female movie characters and dynamic dames, what would be put in my book. I don't see that number really rising. And I just looked at a statistic that said currently, or in 2018, 51% of moviegoers were female. So the audiences are there. Mm. The audiences are there, but I don't see that reflected yet the way it should be.
Right. So who do you see as the ideal reader for Dynamic Dames then? So I guess this book will be picked up and read by a lot of people who are already familiar with many of these women. But I guess hopefully, ideally, it'll become a tool with which to teach viewers about actresses and roles they have no idea about or they haven't been inclined to check out as well. Kind of like the sci-fi book in that respect, I suppose.
Yes, definitely. I hope it's a tool. I envision all types of people reading it. And when I was writing it, I was really picturing all. I want men to read it for sure. It's not just aimed at women at all. It's for men. It's for younger. It's for older. It's really for everyone. I mean, I see more women probably responding to it, obviously. But I hope it's not just limited to women like me who would buy it anyway, who would know about these women anyway, and who appreciate these women anyway.
Yeah, and I think also one thing that's important to note about your analysis here is that we've mentioned the characters and so on, but it's not just about the characters, it's also about the women behind the roles. So presumably you felt you couldn't discuss one without the other, is that right?
That's right. And also that was part of the criteria for me, okay. My selection of the 50, yes, was does it have a strong woman behind it, this movie, in some way? In some cases, they really don't. I mean, if you look at Rear Window, which is just one I keep using as an example, I guess it's one of my favorites. But, that's a Hitchcock film written with a male director, male screenwriter. But at the same time, Grace Kelly had a lot of sway in her character because the screenwriter did base the character on her. And he did a lot of interviews with her and got to know her as a person. So even in the cases where there's not, in many cases, I would say at least half of Dynamic Dames. In fact, I think I did crunch the numbers and it was about 60% of the 50 Dynamic Dames in the book were created by women or female screenwriters. Yeah. So, yeah. But even if it's not a female screenwriter, female director, female producer, or the real woman, in some cases who inspired the character, it's the actresses themselves were in many cases silent producers in the sense they had a lot of power, a lot of control. I mean, Greta Garbo, Queen Christina would not exist without Greta Garbo. And I think it's tempting to look at the studio era and say, oh, these women were just sort of puppets. They were just handed assignments by the mogul, the studio bosses, and they just sort of had to fulfill them. Well, no, not if they had enough power. These women were shaping their own careers. They were choosing their roles. Garbo chose her cast, her cameraman, her director. She hired her friend, a female screenwriter, to write the screenplay. So there's a lot of powerful women behind the roles. And that was just as interesting to me, if not more so, than the characters themselves.
Yeah, one of the things I was interested in was that I kind of skipped over the contents page when I read the book, because I just wanted to be surprised, you know, by who was in it and, mm-hmm. and what roles you'd selected for, you know, some of the performers. So I can imagine that for somebody like, I don't know, let's say Bette Davis, for instance, it must be quite tough to kind of single out one role in particular, perhaps. You could have gone any which way with somebody like her. But you tell me, was it difficult? Were those choices difficult?
No, not at all. Well, not in that case. In some cases, yes. In Bette Davis, no. I knew from the beginning I wanted to write about Ex-Lady because I've loved that movie for years. It's a little bit under the radar, but I was lucky to catch it 15 years ago on Turner Classic Movies. So I've always been a fan of that movie. And there was never any question that it was going to be Helen Bauer as mm-hmm. Ex-Lady. One of the great things I have to say that Turner Classic Movies and Running Press did was let me choose my own characters. They didn't say, no, you have to have Bette Davis in All About Eve because that's the more popular role. You know, they really let me do my thing. And I so appreciate that because, you know, but Margot Channing in All About Eve, I wouldn't particularly call her a dynamic dame. She's very exciting. She's very interesting. She's very smart. She's sexy. I mean, she's a wonderful character. But, you know, to me, it's very much written by a man and what a man's version of a strong woman is, which is at the end of the day, she really just wants to be a housewife.
Yeah, we actually did an extensive episode on All About Eve quite recently where the same mm-hmm. Point was discussed, actually. So I was wondering about the structure of the book then, because like you've alluded to it, it kind of works out that the sort of classic era stuff is more weighted towards the front of the book.
Yes.
But it's not purely that way, is it? So it's quite an interesting structure that it's you have these eight different categories, don't you? Again, how easy was it to draw those up? And perhaps you could just talk about the sort of selection there.
Yeah. You know, the categories were my editor Cindy's idea, Cindy Delahaz, who's also a writer. She said, why don't we break it up into categories and themes? It'll be a little more interesting than just presenting, you know, the 50 chronological women. And I completely agreed, but it took me a while to come up with it's difficult when you have categories because you have to make sure that you have an even number in each category. So, you know, you may have to pick and choose one over the other. You know, I needed the real role models, which was based on real women, category was getting pretty large, and mm-hmm. I needed another strong survivor, so I had to sort of use Angela Bassett as Tina Turner in the strong survivor category, which she fits in, but she's also a real woman. You know, if you think about it, she could go in either category. So there was a little bit of manipulation going on to get the categories right, but I'm happy with how it worked out, and I think it is more interesting to have them categorized this way, certainly. And I also think that, like you said, it just works out because I knew right off the top that, you know, pre-code bad girls was going to be a great category. It's an obvious one. And putting that in the front, you know, was also an obvious choice because those are the earlier days of film. So, yeah, I tried to structure it so that, and I put superheroes as the last category, superheroines rather, because, for the same reason. Those are the newer ones. So, yeah, it kind of works out to be a little bit generally chronological, doesn't it?
Yeah, and it also throws up some really interesting, like, juxtapositions, I think, mm-hmm. where you go from, like, Grace Kelly to Jodie Foster in one page.
Right.
Stuff like that, which I liked. So I was wondering if we could go back to the word maybe reclaiming, because I was just wondering, I feel like when I read the book, there are a couple of passages where you said that, oh, you know, maybe some people argued that this was a stereotype. But actually, this is the way I see it, that kind of thing. And you also mentioned, in relation to someone like Anne Bancroft in The Graduate, you know, the way the perception of the role changed over time and things like that. But it seemed to me like you were very much focused on sort of drawing out the positives here, you know, if there are these contested cases from time to time. But am I reading too much into that?
No, I think you're right on the money. With Anne Bancroft, yes, that's something I feel very passionately about is because I love The Graduate. You know, I first saw it when I was 18 years old, so it's another one of my all-time favorites. But it always bothered me. And when I was younger, I don't think I could really express it or put my finger on it maybe, but it always kind of bothered me how, you know, to me, Mrs. Robinson was this amazingly cool older woman character. And I thought she was so suave and so stylish and so, you know, in control, she seemed to me. And then suddenly, halfway through the movie, we're supposed to see her as this broken down alcoholic who we hate, you know, because she's getting in Benjamin's way, or we're supposed to dislike And so when you really watch The Graduate and you think of it from Mrs. Robinson's perspective, wow, it takes on a whole new, you know, tone. Definitely. The movie is very different. So that's a good example of one that I wanted people to reassess through different eyes. And also Carmen Jones, Dorothy Dandridge, and Carmen Jones is another one that, you know, she's the bad girl, she's the femme fatale, and she is, but, you know, when you look at it through today's eyes, again, can all the blame be placed on her when she, that's who she is, and she tells Joe from the very beginning, this is who I am, baby, you know, like it or leave it. So again, she's just behaving the way men are allowed to behave, really, when you look at it. So yeah, there was a lot of reassessing in this book and putting it into a different context.
Yeah, one I was thinking about was Pam Grier in Coffee, because I just read another TCM Running Press book, actually, which is Donald Bogle's Hollywood Black, and he kind of says, you know, some people see Pam Grier in this light and so on. I've always liked the more celebratory, kind of empowered take on Pam Grier and that sort of era of filmmaking. So yeah, what were your thoughts on, you know, her specifically?
Oh, I agree with you 100%. And Donald Bogle, I mean, she's so empowering to me, you know, and yes, I mean, she undresses, she's in an exploitation film, she is, you know, for all it's worth. But, you know, when she first came into my mind, because again, Coffee is one that I saw years ago and liked it. And she popped into my mind when I wanted to do the book. And then I thought, oh, I haven't seen Coffee in a while. I better rewatch it to make sure, you know, is this really a more insulting film than it is empowering? So I rewatched it and I thought, no, I still like it. And I'm glad I watched it with the director commentary as well, Jack Hill. That really put it in perspective and made me realize, yes, this is an empowered character, because Jack Hill was, you know, treating, as I say in the book, treating his star, the subject matter, with respect that the studios were not often giving the quote unquote blaxploitation films of that time. They were just sort of churning out these violent kind of stereotypical movies, hoping that black people would buy tickets, you know. And he really did a lot more than that. He put a lot more thought into it. And of course she's going to undress. You know, she has this amazing body. It's an exploitation film. There's no way she's not going to take her clothes off and be a sex symbol too. But within that, to me, she's the one holding all the cards. I don't see her as a victim at all. You know, she doesn't come across as a victim, does she?
No, I don't think so. I agree with your take, I think. I was also wondering about a couple of the cases that are a bit more, I don't know, I guess topical. So I'm thinking about somebody like Vivian Leigh in Gone with the Wind, where it just seems like the last few years, there's a lot of heat and discussion around Gone with the Wind, you know, where a lot of people have reevaluated it. I was also thinking of somebody like Uma Thurman in Kill Bill, where some kind of pertinent behind-the-scenes information came to light in the last year or two as well. But yeah, how was it writing about these women where they were kind of, they've come to the forefront in recent years for you know, for one reason or another?
That was really fascinating to me. I felt a little hesitant in some cases because it's not, you know, Turner Classic Movies brand is on the front of the book. And I have to be mindful of that. They understandably don't want to get too political, you know, because that's not their thing. They're about, you know, they want everyone to enjoy these classic movies. So I understood that and I wanted to respect that. But, you know, I couldn't not mention the fact that just, you know, the year before or the year of that I was writing the book, you know, Uma Thurman had just come out and said, with all of this information about Harvey Weinstein and Miramax and the producers and Tarantino and what they had done to her. And the same with Salma Hayek trying to make Frida.
Yeah.
The harassment that she faced at the hands of Harvey Weinstein. So I felt from the beginning, I don't want to whitewash this. I don't want to put it under the rug and pretend it didn't happen. It's part of the story. And the way I looked at it was, if I'm going to talk about, you know, Joan Crawford having to fight to be cast in Mildred Pierce because she wasn't initially wanted in the role, then how can I not talk about Selma Hayek having to fight Harvey Weinstein to get Frida made? You know, it's part of film history. It had to go in there. And they understood Turner Classic Movies, you know, they accepted it. So it's in there.
Yeah. So something else that maybe is relevant when you've got very, you know, films that have been dissected endlessly, whether it's Gone with the Wind or whether it's, you know, Alien or Star Wars. How was that as a writer where you know that hundreds of people have written about these films? How do you find a fresh way in to doing this?
Well, with the sci-fi, it was more difficult, I have to say, because I thought it was really intimidating to write about a movie like Star Wars and Alien and think, well, what kind of fresh spin can I possibly put on it, you know? But with Dynamic Dames, it was easier because there's not a lot about these movies written from a female and a feminist perspective, really, even Alien. There's a fair amount, but I didn't feel like that had been saturated at all. So that was pretty easy just to come at it from my perspective, which is celebrating the strong female movie characters and what makes them so interesting. It felt fresh to me. I hope it feels fresh to the readers.
Yeah, I think it does. And I was also wondering if some of these women were more enjoyable to write about than others. So, I mean, this may just be me kind of projecting, but because I haven't seen the Nancy Drew films, for instance, I really enjoyed reading about Benita Granville in that passage. Mm. And it just seemed like writing about her must have been a lot of fun, for instance. But you can tell me.
Yes, it was. No, you're right. I think my enthusiasm is usually pretty contagious. I think it seeps into my writing, which is a good thing. Because, Benita Granville, one of my favorites. She's so plucky. She's so spunky. And she's so, for the time period, just so unusual to me, you know, to see this teenage girl just with a mind of her own. So that was a lot of fun to write about her. It was also fun for me to write about Mae West, you know, because I didn't really grow up with a lot of Mae West movies. I knew who she was, of course, but I don't know, for whatever reason, I didn't watch a lot of her films. So discovering her a little bit later and really delving into her life and her story and her films for this book was such a joy, you know, because she's so unapologetic. She's just so much fun, you know. She's just like the most in-your-face feminist you can imagine in a certain way, and yet men love her because she's all about sex and all about doing everything with a wink and a joke, you know, which is very powerful what she did and wrote all her own films. And so a lot of these women were really, really fun to write about, but those are the two that come to mind.
And I think we should also spend a bit of time discussing like the look of the book, because it's just a gorgeous thing just to hold and to leaf through. What can you tell us about how did the visual style of the book develop?
Yeah, it was the designer at Running Press really was responsible for it more than me. I was responsible largely for the cover. That was very important to me. I really kind of pushed the designer to come up with a cover that I was happy with. And she did. She delivered. I think initially there were some rough covers where there were maybe six different women, and they were all sort of in a box, you know, just like tiles, a picture of the women, like the Brady Bunch, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
And I sort of fought against that. I was like, no. We can't have these women in boxes, first of all. Maybe I'm reading too much into it, but it just symbolizes them being boxed in, and I don't want that. I want them out of boxes. I want them, you know, grouped together. And also, I think there was some discussion about maybe just having one woman on the cover. And I thought, and I really spoke up and said, no, I want more than one woman on the cover. Because it's a group effort, you know. This book was made possible by my editor, as I said, and other women, you know, so this is like a women empowerment and women coming together kind of theme to me. And that's what I wanted the cover to represent, is we're all in this together. It's not about, you know, being competitive with other women. That's only going to bring us down. So I really love how the cover turned out. And the inside, I selected all the photographs for the most part with the help of Manoa Bowman, whose archive we used. And I wanted the photographs to be empowering of these women. You know, I really selected poses where they don't look like victims, I guess. Mm. That was the extent of my contribution. It was Amanda, the designer, who came up with the rest.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about that cover then, because it's fascinating. So we've got, Gal Gadot, or I'm not, never sure whether to say Gal Gadot. I don't know which pronunciation you go for.
Yeah, I think it's Gal Gadot is usually here.
Okay, so from Wonder Woman, of course, and Uma Thurman from Kill Bill, Dorothy Dandridge from Carmen Jones, Carrie Fisher in Star Wars, and Grace Kelly from Rear Window, with Dorothy Dandridge front and center, we should say.
Yes.
So, yeah, could you say a bit more about that choice and why those five women in particular, perhaps?
Yeah, you know, Dorothy Dandridge, again, Manoah Bowman has this amazing photo archive, and he is a Dorothy Dandridge fan, so he had some great pictures of Dorothy Dandridge. We were looking at this picture and we thought she needs to go on the cover. The way her hands are on her hips,
yeah,
she looks very much in control. So we wanted her front and center on the cover. And that is an argument that we, or not an argument, but that's a point that we, you know, that was obviously granted to us. As far as the other women go, I just sent in various photographs, you know, and it was the designer who came up with the ultimate combination of these women. I think it was difficult at first to get the right combination, not because it wasn't so much, you know, calculated as far as, oh, Princess Leia has to be in here for this specific reason and Grace Kelly has to be in here for this specific reason. It was more how they look together. You know, I think you can throw a bunch of women together and they may look like they just don't belong in some way from a visual designer. Mm-hmm. So this is just the combination that worked. But I love it. I love that we got these women in here. They all look strong, powerful, in control. There's a variety, nice variety.
Yeah, I mean, just before we go in a few minutes, but I just wanted to emphasize again, anyone thinking about picking this book up as a gift or just wondering whether to check it out or not, I guess with the way it's designed, we should re-emphasize. So this is something that can be read, like I've read it, in quite a short span of time, you know, and I really enjoyed it. Or this can be used to accompany rewatches, or just something that's dipped into from time to time, I guess. So perhaps, I don't know if you'd agree, presumably you would, but that's one of the strengths of it, I would suggest.
Yes, exactly. I think we wanted to keep it, you know, having 50 women and making it not a huge book keeps it brief. I think it's about 700 words or something each on each woman. So it's just enough to really get into the, you know, what makes them so cool, get into a lot of ideas about the characters, the backstory, the history of the women. But it's not too much to be overwhelming. It can be a light read, like you said. You can take it to the beach in a beach, yeah, bag this summer easily. But it also, one thing I like about it is it reminds me, the way it doesn't have a dust cover, and the size reminds me of textbooks I used to have in school. And I think of it as also a textbook. It's an entertaining textbook because, you know, hasn't been a whole lot written, you know, about this specific topic, I feel like. So I hope it becomes an invaluable resource.
You know, because I'm talking to you, because I'm talking to a writer, I feel like the obligatory question is always like, what's next? What's the next project? But are you still in, presumably now you'll be publicizing Dynamic Dames for a bit, or are you straight onto the next project, or how does it work exactly?
I am working on a couple of different projects. I'm working on a book, which is a secret at this point. And okay. I'm working on a play, actually, which will be themed, which has a classic Hollywood women theme to it. So we'll see if that ever gets produced. But it's a fun project I'm sort of passionate about. And I'm working as a consultant on a documentary about Natalie Wood, which is coming to HBO in 2020.
Awesome. Now, so presumably the book is available wherever good books are sold, but what about you, Sloane? Where can people find you online? Am I right in thinking you're not on the likes of Twitter and so on? But you do have your own website, though, don't you?
Yes, they can find me anywhere online. Just Google my name and my website comes up. Yeah. People can even reach me there through an email form. So I'm definitely reachable online. I don't tend to do a lot of social media. I'm not on Facebook. Mm-hmm. I do have there's a Twitter account for Dynamic Dames, and I have been doing promoting it also on Instagram. So people can follow Dynamic Dames on there. It's a lot more than just the book, people, on social media. It branches out. It's a lot of different women, newer women, older women, women who, again, are not just the 50 in the book, but a lot more that's just celebrating these powerful, interesting women in films.
Great stuff. Well, thanks ever so much, Sloane, for joining me today. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, Carl. It's been a pleasure for me, and I'm glad I could be here.
Okay, listeners. So, I mean, before our next episode, you can find the Movie Palace in all the usual places, principally on Twitter at Movie Palace Pod, but also on Facebook, also on Instagram. So that's it for today, listeners. I hope you can join me next time when the curtain rises once again at the Movie Palace. If you enjoyed this episode of the Movie Palace and you'd like to support the podcast financially, you can buy me a cup of coffee via the Ko-fi website. Go to ko-fi.com/Carl Sweeney. That's ko-fi.com/Carl Sweeney. C-A-R-L-S-W-E-N-E-Y. Thank you.